Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this Voices of National Service podcast from ABF, the soldiers' charity, marking 60 years since the last conscript left the British Army. Conscription was reintroduced after the Second World War under the National Service Act 1948. From the 1st of January 1949, healthy males from 17 to 21 years old were required to serve in the armed forces for 18 months, with those who showed promise eligible for commissioner's officers. On completion of their service, national servicemen had to remain on the reserve list for 4 years, liable to be recalled to their units for up to 20 days on no more than 3 occasions during their reserve commitment. Men were exempt from national service if they worked for 8 years in one of the 3 essential services, coal mining, farming, and the merchant navy. If they quit early, they were subject to being called up. Exemption continued for conscientious objectors. In October 1950, in response to the British involvement in the Korean War, the service period was extended to 2 years. In compensation, the reserve period was reduced by 6 months. Over 2 million men were called up for service in the armed forces during the 16 years of national service, playing an active role on operations from the Berlin airlift to Korea, the Malayan emergency, the Cyprus emergency, the Myanmar uprising in Kenya, and the Suez crisis in 1956, with a loss of 395 personnel. Former Chief of the Defence Staff, General the Lord Richards of Hurst Manseau, explains why conscription was necessary.
Without national service, given the UK's global responsibilities at the time, and don't forget, as you know well, Harry, I mean, the country was in a completely different situation then. It was post-Second World War, it was withdrawal from empire, but a lot of responsibilities in that process. So without national service, I just don't think that the country could have met its obligations. So scale, mass, numbers really mattered. And the only way that a country in that period and even today can generate that number is through national service, which is why some countries still who feel threatened or who have, you know, aggressive instincts still go for conscription. Within that, you know, we were running Cyprus, we were in the Far East, we were in the Middle East, in the Gulf, all over the world, and therefore these national servicemen were the only way that we were going to meet our obligations and responsibilities.
One of the early conscripts called up for national service in 1949 at the age of 18 was 92-year-old Stan Pell, now a resident of the Royal Star and Garter Home in Solihull, who joined the Royal Signals at Catterick in North Yorkshire, where he was taught to drive. Within weeks, he was posted to an air formation signal squadron of the Rhine Army in Germany, supporting the Berlin airlift, the first major international crisis of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union blockaded the Allied sectors of Berlin.
So we'd done a month's training, and then we went on courses. And, well, everybody wanted to be a driver, but there was just about 10 that was picked. And so we went to Barnard Castle, County Durham, done our course. When we finished, we posted to Germany. And you had to pass your test on a 3-tonner, 1,500 weight, and a Jeep, all in one day.
Retired schoolmaster Howard Shaw, 89, who was later commissioned into the Royal Artillery, describes the prospect of waiting to be called up.
Well, I'd certainly sort of knew it was coming, and I'd been advised by my Oxford college that I should do national service first rather than later. And I'd been in the Corps at school, so I had some what you might call very basic military knowledge. But I think as one was approaching something which was, by its very nature, unknown, there was a certain nervousness in prospect.
You joined the Royal Artillery, but it wasn't guaranteed you'd go to the Royal Artillery. What was the system for selection of A, as an officer, and B, to your regiment that you would end up going to?
I was simply sent a paper saying, telling me where to report to, and I was sent straight to Oswestry.
So you report to Oswestry, but then you're a gunner. You're not an officer at this point.
No,
so
no,
you
no.
You were selected for officer training.
Well, initially, everybody, regardless of one's background, did the same basic training, and I can't remember how long it was, but whether it was 6 weeks or 3 months or something like that, but everybody did the same basic training. And then, if one was thought to be a possible officer material, one went to, I think it was Barton Stacey, where you spent 3-4 days doing various tasks. And if you showed that you had some leadership potential, you were told that you could go as an officer cadet.
What was your impressions when you first arrived at Oswestry with all your fellow recruits at the time, from all walks of life? What was your impression of those few days? It must have been quite hard, was it?
Let me say, it was interesting. Most of the people in my first barrack room were the sons of miners in South Wales. And they had never been away from home before. So they were coping with that, whereas I had been away at boarding school since the age of 7, so this business of being away from home meant nothing to me. So they did two things. They were either crying for their mothers or singing, and they sang all night, or so it seemed to me.
And what was your impression of your instructors, the sergeants who grabbed as you came to the barrack gate?
Most of them had served in the war, and so I mean, they didn't boast about it, but you knew they had. And if one had a social, well, in a moment where you talked to them, you realised that they were men of experience. And, I mean, I respected all of them. I thought they were all very impressive, actually.
Former Buckingham Palace paperboy and Stoll housing resident George Brown, now 89, was a trainee mechanic when he was called up in 1952. With war raging at the time in Korea, he ended up serving far from home.
When I first went in, I was a trainee mechanic when I got called up, 80. And I thought they might put me in the Royal Engineers or something like that. But no, unless you was an apprentice, they found a job for you, and they wanted infantrymen. So they actually sent me to Ireland to be trained as an infantryman, and I was trained in the Inniskilling Fusiliers. There, as an infantryman, fairly accomplished one, because I became I could work the 2-inch mortar. I could also run the MMG machine gun. So I was quite a trained man. And the Liverpool Regiment was already in Korea. So they needed buck up. So immediately they transferred us from the Inniskillings to...
And did you change cap badge too?
Yes. Of course we lost the cap badge. I got the King's Regiment.
Officer training, which lasted 16 weeks, took place at either Eaton Hall Officer Cadet Training Unit in Cheshire or Mons Officer Cadet School at Aldershot, whose Regimental Sergeant Major was the legendary RSM Ronald Britton MBE Coldstream Guards, who spent 19 of his 36 years as a Regimental Sergeant Major and was known as The Voice, his word of command so loud that when he shouted on the drill square in Chelsea Barracks, it could be heard in Victoria Station. Howard Shaw.
We were all standing on the parade ground being drilled, and Britain was out at the front, and he shouted to one of the sergeants on the parade ground in front of us, he said, there's a man beside you, Sergeant. He's standing idly. Take his name. And I was worried that this might be me, but in fact it was the man standing next to me. And the sergeant replied back to Sergeant Major Britton, he's standing on a stone, sir. Then he's standing idly on a stone, says Sergeant Major Britton. Take his name.
Wake up, you idle man.
87-year-old Bob Sewell, who lives in the Royal Star and Garter home, Surbiton, wouldn't take no for an answer after he failed his Army Medical first time round. Hoping to join his local regiment, the East Surreys, and never having cooked before, he ended up in the Army Catering Corps, where he learned a trade which set him up for the rest of his life.
I wanted to go to the East Surreys Regiment, as was running then, but instead of that, Army Catering Corps.
So in those days we had regimental cooks, and you were there running field kitchens. What was your reaction when you first went to training?
When I first
when you turned up on day one at the training depot, where was that?
Aldershot.
Yeah.
And then we I was trained at Aldershot for attached to one of the regiments there, just to learn cooking and all sorts of things. And
what was your basic training like when you were doing square bashing and things like that? What was your reaction to that?
You're an army first, a cook afterwards. Yeah. That's their motto. You're a soldier, happen to be cooking.
And so, how did you find it? When you started to learn to cook, cooking for 200 men a day, that's not
very difficult. After putting a little joint in the oven, you had four or five joints or different things, you know, to cook. Way beyond my experience, but it was a grand experience because I was able to take it up when I came out of the army.
Yeah.
John Keatley, who was called up in 1951 and commissioned into the Duke of Wellington's regiment, volunteered for service in Korea, where he and his battalion fought with distinction in the hard going at the Battle of the Hook.
I didn't think my brother had gained at all, my elder brother, had gained at all from his national service. He'd gone to Gibraltar, and I think he'd wasted his time.
And so you were doing something constructive and useful. Did you think it was a little strange that the national servicemen were largely sort of bearing the brunt of the Korean War?
Well, in a way, I mean, I have to, don't I? I mean, they were totally, totally untrained. I'll give you an example. The first person to be killed in the Duke of Wellington, we used to call them the Dukes, yeah, was a chap called Mulrooney. Irish, of course. We were all, well, the other ranks were, living in trenches. You dug a trench, rather like a grave. Over the top of it, you put a pup. Is it called a pup tent? The trench was, I think, about 4 feet or 5 feet deep. And you could sit on the edge of the trench and with your feet in the down the trench, and the tent was over the top. He was cleaning his grenade. We were issued grenades almost as soon as we got to the hook. Cleaning a grenade, a totally untrained private soldier cleaning, and it
went off and he was killed. That says quite a lot. And I knew nothing at all. My training had been ill. At Catterick, where I started, we were marching up and down all the time, but we never really learned anything. We went to Eton Hall, we learned a lot more about map reading and that sort of thing. But I would never say that I was well trained or adequately trained.
But National Service was a great leveller, forging the many strands of British society into one. Never mind military training, its very being grounded a generation with at times sad or unpalatable lessons in life itself. As Howard Shaw, then an officer in the Royal Artillery, recalls.
One day, quite out of the blue, one of my chaps came up to me and said, sir, I wonder if you could help me. And I said, well, I will if I can. And he said, well, my wife lives in London and I haven't seen her for some months and she can't afford to come up here and I can't afford to go down there. And would you be kind enough to write a letter? And I said, well, of course I will. I said, I shan't make it up for you. You tell me what you want me to say. So we sat down and I wrote a letter for him. And indeed, within... Once I'd done that, another couple of men in my squad came up to me and said, oh, sir, you wrote a letter for Fred the other day. I've got a girlfriend in Manchester. Would you be kind enough to write a letter for me? Because I can't read and write. And I said, well, of course I will. But I found this quite a shock to the system because I had no idea that there were people who couldn't read and write.
Bob Sewell of the Army Catering Corps attached to the Northamptons recalls the rigours of cooking in Korea.
It was very, very cold winter. And I recall cracking an egg, and you cracked it, and then you had to peel the shell off and plop the egg as it was frozen in the frying pan. I said frying pan, it was a big pan, and... Mm. Dozens of eggs and one, two, three, and you put them in and the assistant cook come and took them out and served them. That's how it was.
and I recall there was an instance when you were given the opportunity to cook the men Christmas lunch.
Oh, yes, that's right. And they come up to me and said, Cookie, you was called, Sergeant always called me Cookie. You know, he said, Cookie, got something for you. Two turkeys. Now, how the hell do you cook two turkeys on no oven? Well, everything was on top cooking because there was no oven. And the Royal Engineers kindly made me an oven. It was two oil drums welded together and the edge was cut, the front was cut out and they put a shelf in and in went the oven, the turkeys. It was a bit burnt, but they cooked. the stove was fueled by oil, by petrol.
Right.
It's come down from a drum onto a pad, that's what I call a pad, a brick, under the ovens, and as it hit it, and heat came, but it was very irregular. You couldn't push down the monitor or anything. It was hot or cold.
At the end of 2 years National Service, the armed forces undoubtedly left their mark on impressionable young men who, on discharge, sought to pick up where they left off before call-up. Some left with trades or qualifications that set them up for the rest of their years. Others completed further education, resumed careers, or embarked on a new direction as a result of their military experiences. Howard Shaw and Bob Sewell.
I realised subsequently that, as it were, my generation, particularly at Oxford, who had 99% done their national service first, were more grown up than we would have been if we hadn't. And so we took life much more seriously as a result of our experience in national service, I think. I mean, there was no doubt it. In the 2 years that I was there, I grew up fast because, I mean, you couldn't hang about. And certainly it was be with people of all sorts and conditions, many of whom were absolutely delightful. I mean, having been at public school, I had really only met one social set, but suddenly to be mixing with, as I say, these miners from South Wales and so on. It was a formative period, and I regard it as being extremely valuable.
It was all good experience, because when I left the army, I didn't have any qualifications, but I went to the Normansfield Hospital cooking for 200 or 300 people. Yeah.
The Suez Crisis of 1956 forced Britain to reassess its use of the armed services. The threat of nuclear weapons rendered a large defence force ineffective, as it could only be met with nuclear deterrence. A large army was replaced by a rapid deployment force with modern weapons and equipment. The Defence Review of 1957 initiated a difficult period of transition. The large numbers of men absorbed into national service had become a burden to the army, tying up regular soldiers in training new recruits. National service also drained workers from the economy, which resulted in opposition from the public, the government, industry, and many high-ranking officers. The last national serviceman, Second Lieutenant Richard Vaughan of the Royal Army Pay Corps, was discharged from the army 60 years ago on the 16th of May, 1963, and 4 weeks later, transferred to the reserve on the 14th of June. But what of national service today? General the Lord Richards.
And of course, the byproduct was, I think, socially, if you ever talk to a national serviceman, to a man, they will say that it made them the people they are. So it had that wonderful societal spin-off.
Do you think that a nation would benefit from a return to national service today?
Two aspects of that, really. Politically, I think it's a non-starter today. Just, you know, make sure we stay in the realms of reality, because I just don't think, unless we were threatened by a great power that we decided to gear ourselves up for World War III over, and I you know, God forbid that should happen. I don't think it will. So I think that's very important. The political moment has gone. But to actually get to the point of your question, yes, I do. I think it would root everyone of whatever background in this country, if you like, in a common culture and ethos and cause. And while at the moment there's a sort of, we sort of get by, I can see all sorts of troubles coming downstream at us over, you know, diversity, racism, all these sort of things, which actually I found in the army weren't a factor, and I'm sure you'll think the same, because we thought and acted differently and accepted people for what they are.
The reduced size of our armed forces today, might national service be something that we could consider in terms of reserve service, where we could have a larger force based on reserves, as in the Swiss model, something like that, do you think?
Yes, I've been in meetings and conferences where that is suggested. I'm not a great fan of putting too much emphasis on reservists from a military perspective, because I prize high readiness and great professionalism. And while reservists are without doubt of the right sort of person to be very valuable members of the armed forces, by definition, they are lower readiness, or virtually all of them are lower readiness, and can only come into their own after a period of long preparation and sort of crisis management, all those sort of things. So while it is an option, and maybe the world situation will develop differently and Russia will become a longer term threat as a result of Ukraine and China, you know, ditto. But my goodness me, I hope this isn't the case, because, you know, when I think back even to my own experience as a boy in the 50s, a little boy in the 60s, you know, with rationing and all the things that go with that environment, that's not what we want. And therefore, I wouldn't advocate it as a solution to manning problems in the army. I think it's in a different category, in a different environment.
I presume the same argument will go for using it as a bait or an alternative option for short prison sentences too, I imagine.
Yeah, but not from my point. You and I were professional soldiers, and we know just how demanding that is, and how to reach the sort of standards we aspired to, you had to be very committed. And anyway, we want the very best people in the armed forces, partly in order to meet those commitments with any conviction. So while I'm sure there are some prisoners who would, and historically it's the case, very good soldiers, they're very much going to be in the minority. And as long as they've done their time and, you know, can prove that they're the right caliber, then why not let them join the army? But as a source of recruits, no, I think better that we improve the offer and the sense of service for those who have joined the armed forces, rather than go to the local nick to find armed recruits.
But it would be very hard for our armed forces today if national service was introduced tomorrow. It'd be almost impossible for the armed forces to take up the training commitment to train them up.
Yes, I mean, when I was asked, I have had politicians ask me this on and off, ponder national service's return, and I always start by saying, well, what do you want the regular army to do? Be ready to go on operations at short notice and do our stuff, or train a much bigger army for possible use in some sort of state-on-state war of the future. Unless you grow the regular army massively too, then that's not going to be a solution. And I should say, I mean, I tried to find before we started speaking what the proportion of GDP was that we spent on defence in the period of national service. And I think it gets up to around 10%. Yeah. Well, you know, then prevaricating now about whether 2% is plausible and possible. And so we'd have to be in a completely different era to recreate national service and be able to go on operations at the same time.
National service defined a generation and was a significant influence on the one which followed. 2 million young men were conscripted into the armed forces over the 16-year period. They more than played their part in the defence of the nation, her dominions and allies across the globe. 395 names on the Roll of Honour are testament to that. 2 weeks ago, the Princess Royal addressed National Service veterans and their families at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire to mark the 60th anniversary of the end of conscription. Some thrived, others endured, she said, but all were called upon to give up their time for this country, and they did just that. We at ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, salute our National Service veterans who can be justly proud of a duty well done. And in so doing, we thank you all for your service. But the last word goes to former Army Chef and Royal Star and Garter Home resident, Bob Sewell.
It made a man of me and lots of other people. It was, you learn in the hard way. And I mean, the Sergeant Major, his favourite words was, you might have broken your mother's heart, but you won't break mine. And that was the way they taught us in the Army. And it was really good. I think it made my life, you know.
Anyone who has served for at least one day in His Majesty's Armed Forces, either regular or reserve, qualifies as a veteran. ABF, the Soldiers Charity, is the Army's national charity, here for soldiers past and present and their families for life. We stand at the forefront of support for the Army family, last year assisting over 65,000 people in 48 countries worldwide. A reminder that we continue to safeguard our soldiers, veterans and their immediate families so they can lead a life of independence and dignity for the service they've given to our freedom and liberty. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. If you would like to learn more about the work of ABF the Soldiers Charity, the national charity of the British Army, please visit soldierscharity.org. And my thanks to General the Lord Richards, Howard Shaw, John Keatley, Stull Housing resident George Brown, and Royal Star and Garter Home residents Bob Sewell and Stan Pell for taking part in the programme, and to the many more who helped make it happen. ABF the Soldiers Charity is proud to be a long-term supporter, both the Erskine Edinburgh and Royal Star and Garter care homes, who look after our ageing veterans. From me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening, and farewell. With studio editing by Steve Campbell at Creative Radio, this has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.